I find that a very puzzling reason for going to Washington. For me, that would be rather like going to your best friend's house in order to tell all of the rest of your friends that you like them. At a time when the real security threats to both of our nations are in the form of a pandemic and economic collapse.
One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and we're recording this on Tuesday, the 4th of August, 2020. And in the midst of this global pandemic, Foreign Affairs Minister Maurice Payne and Defence Minister Linda Reynolds travelled all the way to the United States to participate in our regular AusMin talks, the Australia-US Ministerial Consultations. It's the principal forum for bilateral consultations with the United States.
Senior government ministers have arrived in Washington for talks described as the most important in years. Defence and China.
Wearing protective face masks, the Defence Minister Linda Reynolds and the Foreign Minister Maurice Payne have landed in Washington DC for the annual AusMin talks with their US counterparts.
Built on the fact that we are both strong liberal democracies, and it's built on our confidence in making decisions in our interests.
We all keep working with our Australian partners to reassert the rule of law in the South China Sea, which the United States and Australia have both underscored in recent important statements.
Australia declined to commit to freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea, sailing close to disputed territory.
The relationship that we have with China is important, and we have no intention of injuring it. But nor do we intend to do things that are contrary to our interests.
I was arguing even 5 years ago that we were moving into, we had already reached something that I called a new world disorder.
Following tonight, a new six-figure number that drives home the scope of the coronavirus crisis and the suffering. The U.S. death toll now above 150,000.
The state of disaster, officially declared in Victoria yesterday, will be a hammer blow to the country's second largest economy, with major consequences for the national recovery from this pandemic.
Australian Defence Force personnel have been chatting with drivers at checkpoints for some time, but today troops are out patrolling Melbourne's streets.
But given that we are in the middle of a pandemic and that the United States is really the epicentre of a lot of that infection, many observers questioned both the timing of the visit and the substance of the talks, particularly given the proximity to the United States presidential election. So today I'm joined by Alan Beam, head of the Australia Institute's International and Security Affairs Program, to discuss the outcome of those AusMin talks and our wider relationship with the United States. G'day, Alan.
G'day, Ebony.
So firstly, Alan, why do you think that the two ministers, Maurice Payne and Linda Reynolds, went all the way to Washington during a pandemic?
Well, I reckon that that's a very good question, Ebony. Quite frankly, I could not see any real advantage in the timing, and the agenda was essentially pro forma. So here we are in the middle of what is the most remarkable pandemic the world has had in over 100 years, and the problems confronting Australia at the moment are deep and vast, big economic problems, where we've got two senior cabinet ministers who are out of the country for a week and then in quarantine for 2 weeks. I just find that pretty extraordinary, really. And for the defence minister in particular, at a time when we're calling upon the Australian Defence Force to provide various forms of assistance to the states, the minister must surely be available, not just for consultation, but to be part of the cabinet itself. So it is a bit extraordinary.
And it does seem like quite an investment of time because, of course, now that they're back, they have to go into quarantine.
Well, I'm sure they'll be on the phones and doing their business that way. But as I say, it's a time of really great stress. And it is important where possible that people are personally engaged in these cabinet meetings so that they can talk to each other, look at each other while they're talking, understand perfectly well how the body language works and all of those sorts of things. These are serious times. And I think to spend the best part of 3 weeks out of action for very little direct need or benefit is a strange thing to do.
Mm. So some say that the purpose of the meeting was to provide an opportunity to show a bit of separation from the United States on the issue of China. Is that the purpose, do you think? And do you think it worked?
Look, I think the meeting probably had a number of different purposes, and that could have been one of them, though I'll come back to that in a minute, because even that would be quite extraordinary. We do like to remind the Americans all the time that we exist, and we like to make big gestures to make them realize that we exist and to feel comfortable that we're giving them all the attention that we possibly can. So the gesture itself, getting on the airplane and last Sunday week and then flying off desperately for Washington, staying there for a few hours and then turning around and coming back again, that's very, very big gesture to remind something that the Americans are perfectly well aware of anyway.
Mm.
Pompeo has actually been mentioning Australia in his various speeches for a couple of months now, so he doesn't need to be reminded that we exist. Now, a couple of the commentators have said that perhaps the real reason for the visit was so that Senator Payne could stand there and make the pronouncement that Australia makes its decisions in its own interests, and that we're always going to do that, but particularly with respect to things like freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea.
The relationship that we have with China is important, and we have no intention of injuring it, but nor do we intend to do things that are contrary to our interests.
I find that a very puzzling reason for going to Washington. For me, that would be rather like going to your best friend's house in order to tell all of the rest of your friends that you like them. It's quite an extraordinary way of doing things. I think it's naive, if that was the intention, and rather amateur. The best way to signal, particularly to China, that we are independent in our decision-making is to make your statements in the Parliament of Australia. That's by far the best way, because you're on your own territory making your own pronouncements in your own interests. So all in all, I can't see that the visit to Washington and all the media that it got in Australia, it didn't get much in the United States, I might tell you, but all the media it got here is barely worth the tremendous effort that they've had to put into it.
And, yeah, I was going to ask, what really are the outcomes of this? Is there anything demonstrable that Australia got?
The only thing that I can see that is clear is that Senator Payne was able to say that we're going to continue to conduct our freedom of navigation operations as we always have, and that is outside the 12 nautical mile limit of the putative Chinese claim. Now, she could have told Secretary Pompeo that on the phone, I think. That is how Australia has been conducting them for some time now.
I was going to say that that's not a shift in...
No, it's not a shift at all.
Yeah.
And so whether it was her intention simply to make sure that the Americans knew that we were going to continue to participate, but on our terms, it's an extraordinary gesture, I think, to deliver very little in the way of real messaging.
And what, if anything, did the United States get out of Australia travelling all that way for those talks? Well, obviously not media, but what else were they looking for?
Oh, I think that the United States, it's always good for the United States at a time when there are various frictions within its alliance systems to have at least one ally who turns up all the time, on time, and does whatever is necessary to make the United States feel good about itself.
Going back to that deputy sheriff role.
Well, that's right. And I think that that is rather a demeaning role for Australia, particularly in our part of the world. We have our own business to conduct here. And in order to be successful in conducting it, we need to have our own quite particular sets of relationships with the countries of Asia, including China. So I think that to give comfort and succor to the Trump administration in the middle of a pandemic at a time when its alliances, whether with South Korea or Japan or with NATO, are all under different sorts of stress. You might recall that the president of France, Mr. Macron, said last year that, in his opinion, NATO had gone brain dead. Mm. So that does indicate stress in that very important European alliance. So for Australia to be rushing over to Washington to remind the United States that we're still its bestie is, I think, rather unusual.
And I guess how much should we read into the timing of this visit and the proximity to the presidential election? How bound up is this visit in US domestic politics, do you think?
Well, again, some commentators have concluded that part of the reason for this was to indicate to President Trump and his administration that we're still their friends and still support them. For me, I just wonder how smart a move that might be, given that the polls are solidifying behind Mr. Biden's quest for the presidency. And if in November, which is sort of the elections are about 90 days away now, if on November the 3rd, Mr. Biden becomes the president of the United States and is elected as president of the United States, he won't become president until the 20th of January 21. If that were to occur, then I guess we'll be wanting to renew our pledges of loyalty, friendship and obeisance and affection to a new president as soon as we possibly can. So it just makes us look a bit needy, I think.
Yeah. Alan, you've recently written a paper for the Australia Institute about the ANZUS Treaty, which is variously referred to as kind of the bedrock or the cornerstone of our alliance or our relationship with the United States. What value is ANZUS to Australia now compared to when it was first drawn up and we first signed on to it? What's the history there?
Look, ANZUS is a byproduct of a peace treaty between the United States and Japan. At the time that the United States was negotiating its post-war peace treaty with Japan, Australia was very nervous about whether a modernised Japan could rearm and reconstitute a threat to Australia. So at the time, and this is in the immediate post-war years, Mr. Menzies had just been elected and he was in his first term of office. Australia was looking for a hard treaty with Japan, which would keep their industrial capacity down and preclude the possibility of a defence force. The United States, on the other hand, was looking for a soft treaty because they could see that Japan would become a strategic asset to the United States, particularly should China take on some larger strategic form than it had at the time. And, of course, that has certainly happened. Mm. So the ANZUS Treaty was a sop to Australia's insecurity. And once it was signed, we marched ahead and had a treaty that guaranteed our ultimate security, we thought. And it went on that way all the way through the Korean War, all the way through the Vietnam War. At no stage was ANZUS really much brought into calculation until we had the confrontation between Indonesia and Malaysia back in the early 60s. And Australia thought it would go in and support Malaysia in that confrontation, but it needed a bit of reassurance, as we seem always to do. So Prime Minister Menzies, he got on his plane and went off to Washington to have a conversation with President Kennedy, asking the president to make sure that if Australia got attacked by Indonesia, the United States would come and defend us. And President Kennedy very politely told the Prime Minister to go home, that the United States had no intention whatsoever of going to war with Indonesia. And so the ANZUS Treaty sits there as a very nice thing to have because we can do all sorts of things underneath the umbrella of that treaty. But ultimately, as a guarantee of our security, it's effectively useless.
So that's certainly, I think, not the public perception of the ANZUS Treaty. How misunderstood is what that treaty represents and what it would ultimately do for Australia if we ever did come under threat?
Well, what the treaty actually requires of all parties, though at the moment there are only two parties, that's Australia and the United States, is to consult. And if something terrible happens, they can have a chat about it. And if it's really terrible, they can take a few steps about that, like deciding that they're going to engage in armed conflict, but under certain prescriptions that would have them take their actions to the UN Security Council for resolution.
The people of the United States will never forget that Australia invoked our ANZUS Security Treaty for the first and only time following the September 11 terrorist attacks, which claimed the lives of nearly 3,000 innocent people, including 11 Australians.
Now, if you believe that the United States would take any of its business to the United Nations Security Council these days, then you have a great capacity for faith. It is, I think, inconceivable that Article 4 of the ANZUS Treaty would ever be invoked by the United States. And so, again, for that reason, I think the treaty has a political utility, but as a strategic device, I think its utility is rather slender.
And perhaps not very well understood by the public.
No, because I think what governments like to do is to play the symbolic content of the treaty, and under the rubric of warships and marching bands and flypasts, appear to give substance to our deep and long-standing relationship with the US. And you're quite right in your preamble, Ebony. You said that AUSMIN is the principal forum for the conduct of our bilateral relationship with the United States, as though our defence relationship were the talisman of that very complex relationship we have with the US. It's certainly my opinion that we do need to have serious and frequent conversations with our very close partner, but that cannot be limited simply to defence and security matters at a time when the real security threats to both of our nations are in the form of a pandemic and economic collapse.
Yeah, I think that's become really clear with the pandemic that I think, and you and I have talked about this previously, that the securitization of all public policy and that all being bound up in this idea that national security is only about defense, the pandemic's really shown that up to be quite shallow and ineffective, I guess, certainly when it comes to a pandemic, but also climate change and other policy ideas, like you point out.
Oh, no, absolutely right, I think, Ebony. We have, at the Institute, we've been doing quite a lot of work around the fact that in this century, it is much more likely that human security will be the central concern of all governments as they consider the broader dynamics of national security, and that defence capability, that is security against armed adversaries, is likely not to take centre stage because every country in the world has got the same sets of problems. And so where we should be going is to suggest a much greater diplomatic effort so that the world community is able to work in harmony rather than creating obstacles to cooperation.
So to go back to the AUSMIN talks and to go back to that idea of defence, I noticed in today's media there were some suggestions that Australia really has no option but to support the United States if China were to try to integrate Taiwan into China by force. Does the AUSMIN meeting support that idea?
I think you could be excused for thinking that the AUSMIN meeting would allow the United States to make that assumption. The communique it's a fairly standard document, the communique, I might say, but it keeps Australia and the United States in lockstep on all of the major strategic issues. And of course, the key one at the moment is how the United States relates to China. And so the test case for Australia would be, were China to seek to use military force to incorporate Taiwan. And for a long time, we've had strategic commentators in Australia saying, well, yes, of course, Australia would support the United States in sanctioning China in seeking to incorporate Taiwan militarily. Of course, it's not all that long ago when he was foreign minister that Alexander Downer cast quite a lot of sort of doubt on that proposition. And subsequently, defence and foreign ministers have sort of put it a bit up in the air as to whether Australia really would want to rush off and confront the Chinese military forces in Taiwan, supporting the US. But still, we have commentators who say that Australia's support for the United States would be inevitable. An Australian government in that situation would, in my opinion, be making an extraordinarily grave error were it to seek to support American military action against China in any circumstance, because they're both nuclear-armed powers, and the consequence of conflict between those two mighty states would be far-reaching for the entire world community. Our best endeavours would be to seek to calm it down and to keep the all sides, that's China and Taiwan and the United States, at the negotiating table rather than in the theatre of action. So I would strongly contest the view that Australia's support for the US is inevitable. We have agency. We have a capacity to make decisions in our own interest, as Senator Payne said, and in our own interest would certainly mean that we don't get involved in an exchange of gunfire with China.
Mm-hmm. Alan, if you could leave us with one thought, reflecting back on these last couple of days, what would it be?
Look, I think that we need to look at our national security in much, much broader terms currently than simply in terms of the Australian foreign and defence ministers going to Washington to talk about how awful China is and how much both of us need to work together to secure our own futures. I think it would be very much more important for the Australian government to look at security in much broader terms and to invest its energies much, much more in a broader global diplomacy, which would focus on addressing the problems of climate change, working collaboratively to ensure that we can protect human beings from the coronavirus, and ensuring that all countries in the world work together to eliminate nuclear weapons.
Well, we might wrap it up there. Thanks very much, Alan. This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so please stay tuned. And if you've enjoyed these episodes, please make sure you leave a review. It helps other people to find the podcast. You can check out the Australia Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series at our website, tai.org.au/webinars. The next event is on Wednesday, the 5th of August, with former Prime Minister Julia Gillard discussing the pandemic, mental health and beyond. It's free, but registration is essential. So again, head on over to our website. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. And you can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content. And we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. And Alan Beam is at Miranda Process. That's MirandaProSus. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with help from Lucy Law, Holly Forrest and Grace Crivellero. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And keep washing those hands, wear a mask, stay safe, and thanks for listening.